The 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Gentlemen, my name is Shoji Nishimoto. I am an assistant administrator of the United Nations Development Program, in charge of Bureau for Development Policy in New York. And in case you're wondering what I do, I'm basically a chief of the janitor, clean up all the mess if anything goes wrong in the building in the area of policy arena. Anyway, welcome to this. I'd like to welcome you all to this today's session entitled HIV/AIDS and Poverty, Breaking the Vicious Cycle. As I see it, the room is very, very full and makes me wonder what happened. And I was whispered by somebody that somebody spread the rumor that Bill Clinton was coming. Or Richard Gere was supposed to show up and tell us his story. But in spite of this, they're not coming. Let me just come. They're not coming. But in spite of that, I do appreciate this very high attendance, because it really shows your commitment to look at these HIV/AIDS in the context of the number one goal of the Millennium Development Goal of reducing poverty and the hunger. So I'm very pleased to now introduce our panelists today. I will give a more detailed background of each panelist as we move on, but I have starting from to my right, Dr. Sigrun Melagel. She is the Norway's HIV/AIDS ambassador and long-term associate of the UN system. Welcome, Dr. Senator Ambassador. Thank you very much for coming. Next to her is Dr. Simon Mitty. He's the permanent secretary at Zambia's Ministry of Health, followed by Dr. Jita Rao Gupta. She's the president of the International Center for Research on Women. And the farthest right is Mr. Arinafe Kasia. She is the project manager of HIV/AIDS program for CARE Malawi. Without comprehensive strategy to address the impact of AIDS, the achievement of the human development targets set under the Millennium Development Goals could be severely impaired. The AIDS epidemic has reversed valuable development gains, reinforcing cycles of poverty and vulnerability. The development impacts and costs of the epidemic is felt across sectors, straining national and local budgets and driving sectors such as the education and health of skilled workers. As you know, in some cases, the doctors and nurses and teachers and even policemen are dying every day. So today, countries are increasingly recognizing poverty as a factor contributing to vulnerability to HIV/AIDS. There is a strong nexus between HIV/AIDS and poverty, as you all keenly aware and painfully feels every day. And recognizing that addressing the social and economic impacts of AIDS is necessary in tracking poverty. But policy and the program still lag behind. In 2004, a review of poverty reduction strategy papers, this is what we call PRSP, in 19 African countries show that far too many plans are still focused on health sector response to HIV/AIDS. They are not taken as a development challenge, but looking at mostly from the health angle. Only 60% of the papers include an analysis of the link between HIV/AIDS and poverty, where nearly half did not even address HIV at all. But this is a reality. In an effort to alleviate this situation, beginning in 2005, UNDP, the World Bank, and the UNAIDS Secretariat have worked together with 14 countries to more effectively integrate HIV in the development of poverty reduction strategy papers and in their implementation. I mean, paper is one thing, but what matters is implementation, as you would all agree. In many countries, there is a substantial gap, however, between needs and the target of funding. Although funding for HIV response has grown exponentially in the last several years, programmatic efforts to address the linkage between HIV and poverty have been slow to follow. Because as I said, in some cases, the funds are earmarked basically as a health challenge or education challenge and not really looking at the holistic development challenge. Now, getting the money to where it is most needed matters most. And what it counts is an essential part of mitigating the impacts of the epidemic, and community initiative must therefore be a priority for support. I was fortunate enough to take part in the community conversation, the Global Village Function this morning, and you are not short of good examples of what to follow and what to scale up. Now, many families affected by HIV/AIDS face an urgent need to preserve or recover their livelihood, particularly in the area where widespread poverty is already a reality, and women and girls are especially affected by their poverty, creating impact of HIVs that often limit their economic and educational opportunities. So the gender aspect is more than ever important. The challenge, of course, does not only lie with the governments, and there is no doubt that the nature of the epidemic means that countries need sustained and predictable funding that address long-term needs. And adequate funding to meet these requirements depends on fulfillment of commitments made by donors, both at the G8 summit at Green Eagle in Scotland and the World Summit in New York in 2005. In addition, for many countries, unsustainable debt represents a huge barrier to progress in addressing HIV/AIDS, but developing countries must also ensure that the resulting resources coming from the debt forgiveness translated into effective response to HIV challenge in order to protect the future generations. So today, this afternoon, we have been fortunate to have the esteemed panel of experts representing government, civil society, and grassroots organizations who will highlight critical challenges and opportunity in addressing HIV/AIDS and poverty reduction. In keeping up with the conference theme of time to deliver, we'll focus on how action can be taken at global and at the national level to address the bottlenecks in getting financing to where it is needed most. I think some critics I heard on the corridor is that we're still talking and not much action or the further action is needed. Now we'll begin with the speaker presentation followed by an interactive discussion, a Q&A session with you. And finally, we'll close with some sort of sense of recommendation for us to move forward together. So let me now introduce Dr. Sigrun Medela, who currently serves as HIV/AIDS ambassador for Norway, as I mentioned earlier. Having worked closely with both government and the UN in various capacities, Ambassador Medela has a vast experience in addressing HIV/AIDS at global and national levels. She is also a member of the Ethics Committee of the Global Fund to Fight HIV/AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and has played a pivotal role in Norway's efforts to work in partnership with countries affected by the HIV around the world. So, Dr. Sigrun, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Soji, and for that kind introduction. It's hard to be a donor or representing the donor community when we should face how we could break the vicious cycle, how we could keep the promise to end poverty and AIDS. Because if we think about the 25 years of AIDS, what has happened, both in terms of recognizing the causes, the movements to challenge, the drive and the creativity that's been on the AIDS side, and we at the same time look at the 25 years of debate around poverty, it's full of rhetoric, it's full of promises, it's full of conferences, and it does not have the same creativity and drive and energy that we see on the AIDS side. And it's striking that somehow the development community and the AIDS community, if it's possible to divide the world that way, of course it isn't. But it's as if there is a major communication gap in there. I can talk about embassies of Norway in a number of African countries that would say there's too much money in AIDS. We don't really need to have any programs there because there's imbalance in spending. And one uses the instruments, the PRSPs, the national investment plans, the discussion around governance, and talking about the pace of development. And yet, what do we have behind us? We have the Copenhagen summit, where we talked about social investment, social security nets. and we talked about 2020, how we would spend resources, how it would be a compact. Those of you that have been part of that, remember it. Remember the hopes we had when we got the 2020 compact firmly in these promises. Where is the 2020 compact? We have a problem with domestic spending, and we have a problem with external spending. And yet, that was a negotiated conference statement with very few exemptions and very little of the fights that we've had the late years on language. We had the Cairo conference, we had the Beijing conference, and the momentum that tried to demonstrate things we needed to do to deal with social structures and systems and the vulnerabilities of people, and the rationale that if we did that, we would all move to a better world, to a different way of relating. That's the 25 years of poverty. And then, of course, at the turn of the millennium, where the peak of the hopes were, the Millennium Conference, the Monterrey Consensus about financing for development. I'm reminding you about this because I think the missed opportunities of those agendas is very central to what we need to talk about when we should link the AIDS response. There is no need to start to negotiate new things when we have a lot of... Imagine what would have happened if we had done what we said on those things. And what was very important with those conferences was that it did not just talk about money. It talked about broad social systems and structures and power balances and how we need to deal with them. Now, I would want to say that the gap between negotiated agreements and commitments and the reality on the ground is a fatal one. The gap between what we were able to say in New York some months ago and what was actually said in all the hearings but didn't make it to the statement is a fatal one. And then the question is, how do we break that cycle? Are there glimpses of hope and possibilities? I think we need to promise each other that we do not need all these speeches that's full of rhetoric. I'm not even sure that we need to put two strong men in their best age after having the two bills that we have here as an example to lead the fight. Because it's not a question of just throwing more money or more technology or more willingness to share what we have learned, but it's actually a question of changing from within and changing from bottom up rather than from top down. Then I think the question is, can AIDS help us drive that response? Some of us were part of the 70s talking about participatory movements, community engagements, all those things. And we have a number of examples of hopes, glimpses of wonderful things, but it remains those piloted efforts. And once we tried to make them to blueprints, to big national plans, they lost their energy, they lost their creativity, and they somehow lost the life around them. Let me just, I've only 1 minute left, and because I lost my notes, I'm a little less clear, so if you allow me half a minute more. But I don't need to say that much more, because I think there is a major risk now in the AIDS response, in the sense that we're relying a lot on national plans, and we got to, because we need to get the act together. There are thousands of actors there, and if we're not getting an efficient and effective response, we're not going to make it. So we do need those plans, but we do not need those plans fit into a development structure and planning that has lost its life and become blueprints. We need plans that are alive, plans that are carrying that momentum of energy, civil society participation, challenges, and accountability that we see on the AIDS side. I do believe that we cannot get on with this just by talking about what the international community should be doing. I think that's one of the mistakes on AIDS activism, because I think the process now in countries around those plans, the process of linking the development response and the AIDS response, the health personnel, the gender issues, it's not just to say the right things, even not to get the same laws. I was speaking to my brother from Zambia and their system not very long ago, where we had a discussion of whether AIDS should be discussed when the government presented its national budget, and whether that would give hope to a country or whether that would undermine hope. We need to find a way where AIDS become mainstream politics, mainstream discussions, where information about the status of the epidemic in each country is owned by each of the people there in the country, where one starts to discuss why is it that some women, some situations have this disproportionate effect of women? Why is it that it's different in different parts of the countries? That needs to be a debate within the country. We don't even need to get those answers from UNAIDS or anywhere else. It has to be part of the push of the civil society, forcing this onto an information chain that can inform priorities in that country. Without priorities, these plans will be useless. Making priorities, I'm sure my friend will say, is really hard, because there's so many things that needs to be done. We have to own those priorities, fight for them, live with them. And this is what I think we have to hold each other accountable to. And then we could end up what the political declaration say, no credible, costed, prioritized national plan should go unfunded. Let that be true, but let those plans build on that information, that knowledge, those political processes, those debates, even between regions and between groups in countries, and let then us in the external community respond and be held accountable at that level. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Ambassador. I would like to now to invite Dr. S.K. Mitty to give his remarks. Dr. Mitty is the permanent secretary at the Ministry of Health in Zambia, and prior to taking up this post, he was the director general of the Zambia's Central Board of Health. He is well recognized for his effort to prioritize AIDS response in Zambia. He is basically a health specialist, but also holds MBA, and I think it's an interesting combination. He's currently also chair of the Zambia's country coordination mechanism of the GFATM. So, Dr. Mitty, please.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak at this important conference. And my topic is making money work to benefit people living with HIV and AIDS, the Zambian case. By way of introduction, I would like to first state that Zambia has recognized the problem of HIV and AIDS, and that it is causing poverty. You may wish to note that in Zambia, for the past two decades, the productive sector of the country has been affected by HIV and AIDS. We also know that about 70% of the people are living below the poverty datum line. They are living on $1 per day. The population of Zambia is about 10.3 million people, and the prevalence rate of HIV is about 16%. What has been the Zambia's response to the pandemic? Firstly, I would like to draw your attention that there are structures that have been developed at all levels in the country, beginning with the political leadership. When His Excellency the President, Mr. Mwanawasa, appointed a cabinet committee of ministers who report to him. Below that, we've got the National AIDS Council, which is comprised of all stakeholders, particularly line ministries, people living with HIV and AIDS, faith-based organizations, civil society and traditional leaders. Below that, we've got provincial aid task forces and district task forces, and then we've got community groups who are reporting to the district task forces. Now, what instruments have been used to make money work to benefit people living with HIV and AIDS in Zambia? Firstly, we've developed the National HIV and AIDS Strategic Plan, which is from 2006-2011, and this happens to be a chapter of the National Health Strategic Plan. I would like to also draw your attention that we now have the fifth National Development Plan, which covers all sectors in Zambia, and the National HIV AIDS Plan is a chapter in that plan. I would also like to draw your attention that we have a medium-term expenditure framework, and this has been used to finance the National AIDS Plan. And this was developed through a bottom-up approach using the consultative process. Now, which are the financial resources that we are using? Firstly, it's the government resources. You may wish to note that Zambia, through the Poverty Reduction Strategy paper, used it as a tool for macroeconomic stabilization, as was prescribed by the World Bank and the IMF. I wish to state that Zambia reached the HIPPI completion point in 2003, and the debt relief savings from the HIPPI have been used and channeled to the social sectors, namely education and health. And because of that, the government came up with bold policies, and these include free ARVs to the general public and all the associated costs of lab and drugs for opportunistic infections. The government then also came up with removal of medical user fees in 54 of the 72 districts in all rural areas in Zambia. And we've also developed exemption mechanisms to cover defiled and raped cases, orphans and vulnerable children, the under 5, over 65, and the maternity cases. I would like to state that government has also been providing increased budgetary allocation to health and education sectors as a result of the HIPPI completion point. I would like to also take note that additional resources have been mobilized from the Global Funds, from PEPFAR, the World Bank, the bilaterals and multilaterals. And the key is that all these resources are feeding into one national plan using the three ones principle of one plan, one coordination plan, and one monitoring and evaluation. What are the results so far? Yes, we take note that the free ARVs is working. The program has been scaled up from 4,000 people living with HIV and AIDS in 2002 to over 65,000 as at March in 2006. So from 4,000 to 65,000. It means the 65,000 people are now alive and back to productive work, thereby contributing to the growth of the economy. I wish to state here that Ambassador Stephen Lewis was quite instrumental because he was bold to tell the President of Zambia that free ARVs would actually scale up this intervention, and this is exactly what has happened. I would also like to state that the PMT City programs, VCT, and information and education have been scaled up. and stigmatization have also been reduced. With all these successes, certainly we have some challenges. The financial resources have been mobilized, but are not enough. Critical at the moment is that the human resources crisis is quite bad. Currently, the health workforce is less than 50% capacity in terms of what we require, and hence the scaling up of HIV and AIDS interventions has been quite difficult. Logistics in terms of ARVs and drugs for risk infections has also been inadequate. We've also had a situation, especially at the moment, where most of the health workforce are quite disgruntled, and therefore we tend to have strikes as a way of expressing poverty due to poor conditions of service that are obtaining in the country. And this certainly has disrupted HIV and AIDS programs. And you are all aware of the difficulties we're having because of the what I would call poaching as one of the commonest causes of attrition other than HIV and AIDS in Zambia. We're also seeing a situation where the extended families, particularly grandmothers, are not able to cope with the orphans and vulnerable children, hence making them vulnerable to being defiled or being in the streets, as well as abused. In conclusion, unless the HIV and AIDS and poverty vicious cycle is disrupted, there will be no meaningful social and economic gains achieved in developing countries such as Zambia. Hence the need for massive investment of financial and taking care of the human resources crisis, which in recent years has become the center stage and a problematic area in scaling up HIV/AIDS programs, not only in Zambia, but in developing countries. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Miti, and thank you also for limiting your presentation exactly to 7.5 minutes. It's an art, but well done. Thank you, sir. Our next speaker is Dr. Jita Rao Gupta. Dr. Gupta has been the president of the International Center for Research on Women since 1997. She is an internationally renowned expert on women and HIV and a tireless advocate for the societal and economic empowerment of women as an integrated part of addressing HIV/AIDS. Her groundbreaking plenary address at the 13th International HIV/AIDS Conference in Durban squarely placed the issue of women and HIV on the global development agenda. So Dr. Gupta, please go ahead.
Thank you. I want to bring the discussion down from the macro level, from national economic policies and health system reforms to the household level, because nowhere is the devastating impact of HIV/AIDS felt more strongly and more irreversibly than in poor households and communities. The point I want to make in my remarks and leave you with is that the only way to mitigate that impact is to understand and address the nexus between women, poverty, and HIV. We have known for quite a while that women and girls bear a disproportionate burden of the havoc wreaked by the AIDS epidemic, because in the majority of poor households, they serve as the primary caretakers of the sick and the dying and of orphan children. They are the ones at great cost to their own health who willingly take on the daily, never-ending, back-breaking work of washing wounds, dispensing the little they get by way of medicines, monitoring food intake, providing emotional support, nurturing those in pain, and cleaning all bodily waste. And all this they do willingly, while their governments wax eloquent about the wonders of home-based care, without providing them with even the basics in terms of information, clean water, gloves, fans, syringes, or fuel work. Inevitably, this means that they struggle to maintain their own livelihoods. They can no longer engage in the same way in subsistence agriculture to produce the food, or in the market trade activities that resulted in a meager income that contributed to their household survival. And perhaps more cruel, they are often forced to pull their children out of school to get the extra labor that is needed to substitute for their own to help make ends meet, thereby creating a persistent intergenerational cycle of deprivation and poverty. an effective way to prevent poor households from complete and irreversible destitution in the face of such a crisis is to invest in the economic empowerment of women living in poor communities. Why? First, simply because women deserve better and should not have to struggle so hard to get a reasonable return on their labor. Second, because women and children are overrepresented among the hungry and the poor. Although precise estimates of the relative proportion of males and females living in poverty are not available, research on households headed or maintained by women indicates that they are overrepresented among the poor. And third, because as mothers, food processors, and producers, providers, and income earners, and increasingly as the sole economic providers for a large number of households around the world, women are disproportionately responsible for the survival and well-being of poor households. They produce 50 to 80% of the food. They supply the labor for agricultural production, fetch water, gather fuel wood, cook for the family, sell surplus produce, and serve as the key frontline health and nutrition providers for infants and children. Moreover, we know through robust studies conducted almost two decades ago that income in the hands of women results in relatively greater welfare outcomes for children in terms of education, nutrition, and health than income in the hands of men. Although there are many proven ways to economically empower women living in poverty, in the interests of time, I would like to refer to just one to help women cope in times of crisis and in the long term, give them a leg up from poverty. I'm referring to guaranteeing women and girls their property and inheritance rights, to let them own and control what is rightfully theirs. This is a poverty alleviation measure because secure tenure to land and home protects women in poor households against economic shocks and enables them to take the economic risks that are necessary to climb out of poverty. But as I will show you, increasing women's economic security through ownership of and control over land and housing is also an AIDS prevention and control strategy and must be supported through AIDS budgets. Let me explain. When husbands or fathers fall sick and die of AIDS, or women are sick themselves, they are at risk of losing their homes, inheritance, and possessions, either because of property grabbing by relatives and community members, with no accessible legal recourse to regain their ownership of that property, or because the law of their land does not give women the right to own or inherit land or housing. Thrust into these difficult economic situations, women and girls may be forced into unsafe, risky behavior just to meet their own and their children's basic needs for food, shelter, and housing. Land and housing provide a secure place to live, serve as collateral for loans during financial crises, and are symbols of status in almost every society in the world, all of which can benefit women who are struggling in times of their own or their household health crisis. And we have also known for many years that control over land and housing can give women greater bargaining power within households, and we are now learning that this power can help to protect women against the risk of domestic violence. Research in Kerala, India, found that 49% of women with no property reported physical violence compared to only 7% of women who owned property. Yet there are many countries in which women still do not have the right to own or inherit land or property. And even where such laws exist, most land and property is owned by men because of the poor enforcement of the laws or because of a conflict between statutory laws and customary ones. Currently, it is estimated that worldwide women own less than 15% of land. There are several examples of local and national initiatives to rectify this situation and reduce the disadvantage that women face. In Kenya, there's the Young Widows Advancement Program, founded by five young HIV-positive widows, that provides legal and psychosocial support, including paralegal assistance, will-writing workshops, and support groups to empower Kenyan widows and protect their property and inheritance rights. There are many such. I could give you lots of examples. In other sub-Saharan African countries, of services run by community-based organizations that are poorly funded and desperately need resources. Their efforts also need to be supported by legal and land reform by national governments. Thus, to strengthen women's property and inheritance rights, it is critical to increase the flow of resources to community-based organizations and regional networks that promote women's rights to own and control property. Just yesterday evening, I attended the launching of a new initiative, the 13 campaign set up by the African Women's Development Fund. This effort for and by African women is an effort to mobilize resources for grassroots organizations that are making a difference in the fight against AIDS. It is based on a very creative and innovative idea. 13 symbolizes a reality for African women because there are 13 million African women infected with HIV/AIDS, and there are 13 African women living with HIV for every 10 infected men. Yes, 13 is an unlucky number for some, but the campaign is calling for donations of 13, 130, 1300, 13,000, or even $13 million so that the number 13 can be transformed to become a lucky number for African women. I urge you all to find out more about this effort and contribute as individuals and organizations to this worthy cause that is already supporting the efforts of many dedicated grassroots women's organizations. The website is www.13incampaign.org. In addition, there is an urgent need to provide support in the form of financial and technical support to assist national governments to strengthen and enforce their legal and policy frameworks to guarantee women their right to own and inherit property. In conclusion, let me reiterate today that AIDS feeds on our past mistakes, on the fault lines that inequality and poverty create in societies. Gender inequality and poverty are the primary forces exacerbating the AIDS epidemic. Women, both young and old, are at the forefront of this epidemic, infected in increasingly large numbers and primary caretakers of those who are infected. They are the glue that holds communities together in the face of this epidemic in Africa. They need all the support and resources we can provide them, and at a minimum, they need our respect. There is a very powerful reason for change. The disempowerment of women is killing and incapacitating them and their households. This must stop. And we know how. All it needs is for us to jointly take some responsibility and act. Thank you very much.
Dr. Gupta, I think you hit many of the challenging issues that I also wanted to contribute in this discussion. Maybe we can discuss it later on this, particularly the legal right of protecting the women's inheritance and the access to the productive assets is really critical. We have to demystify the word empowerment or empowering women. What do you really mean by that? So thank you very much for bringing this issue. Now I'd like to now introduce Mr. Arinafe Kasia. He is the project manager of HIV/AIDS program for CARE International in Malawi. With a background in social science, Mr. Kasia has been involved in building capacity of community-based organizations to address HIV/AIDS. Mr. Kasia is also a board member of the Malawi Health Equity Network, which is a grouping of civil society organizations that are advocating for equity in access to health care. So, Mr. Kasia, please.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I'd like to begin by recognizing that today, I think in this era, in the past few years, we've seen an increasing flow of resources to developing countries through such mechanisms such as the Global Fund, but also other mechanisms that are emerging such as the PEPFAR and other private donors such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as just examples of some of the mechanisms that are beginning to emerge and also to facilitate the flow of resources to countries where these resources are needed most. I would also like to recognize that the fight against HIV, or the efforts against HIV and AIDS, if we look at the response at the community level, this is where the heart of the response is, and this is where men and women are volunteering themselves to implement initiatives for the betterment of their own communities. And these are the people that should be supported most in their initiatives, because it's out of that spirit of volunteerism and commitment for the betterment of their own people. And I would like to stress here that as the flow of resources is increasing at global level, we're also beginning to see an increasing amount of resources flowing to countries. For example, a country like Malawi, where I come from. Malawi is a country which has got a very high HIV prevalence. 14.4% of the adult population is HIV positive. we have over 600,000 orphans as a result of HIV/AIDS, and many more people that are living with HIV/AIDS. We have about 1 million people living with HIV/AIDS out of a total population of about 11 million people, and that is a huge problem. Now, in talking about, in talking with you this afternoon, I would like to specifically talk to you about how we need to ensure that resources are flowing to the community-based organizations where they are needed most. It's not enough to have resources flowing into the country if they are not reaching the grassroots where they are needed most. And I'd like to begin by raising four or five areas which are very critical in terms of challenges that we see as people working at the grassroots as regards the flow of resources from the country level or the national level to the community-based organizational level. And one of the big challenges is actually that the fact that the existing mechanisms does not provide the scale required to provide resources to the community-based organizations. If I give the example of Malawi, where I come from, there are hundreds and hundreds of community-based organizations that are in need of resources. And yet, you'd find that the existing mechanism or the mechanisms that are in place cannot adequately cover the need or the demand that is coming from the grassroots. And I think the second challenge that I'd like to raise here is that even though we are seeing a trend in terms of our countries, for example, moving towards decentralization, where we are talking about power to the people and we are decentralizing the authority to address to the district level, that would have offered an opportunity in terms of making sure that resources are flowing through that mechanism to the community-based organizations, and that would have facilitated a smoother process in terms of access. But what we find is that due to lack of capacity, institutional capacity and human resource capacity within the existing local government structure, they do not offer an immediate solution in terms of channeling the money that are flowing into the country to the community-based organizations. And I think the other area that I'd like to raise here as a challenge is, in fact, the funding requirements or the procedures for funding that are, you know, attached to the various sources of funding. And here I'm talking about, for example, the basic procedures to access funding. And we find that in most cases, what we see is that the procedures for funding do favor community-based organizations that are already literate or have a little bit of capacity at the expense of communities where people are illiterate but are willing to do something for the betterment of their own people. And we find this as a problem in terms of what do we do with communities where they may not have the capacity to write a good proposal because they don't know English, but they have a very good concept that they can put together and they need to be supported too. And we find that to be a challenge in terms of ensuring access. And also, I'd like to raise another area that is a challenge for us, and it's the area that I think moving the monies alone to communities or the community-based organizations, from our experience, we see that it is not enough and adequate. And the reason is, if we give the money without strengthening the capacity of the community-based organizations to deliver the services, they do not have, in most cases, the absorptive capacity to deliver, and at the end, we don't see the results. And so some or most of the mechanisms that we are seeing in the countries, yes, they are giving out money, but they are not offering the capacity building that should come with that money to enable the organizations to have better technical capacity and program capacity, even at community level, even though they are volunteers, to deliver the services that that money should be used for. And we find that, again, to be a challenge with most of the mechanisms that are in place. And again, I think I'd also like to bring out another challenge. I think this is a challenge in terms of the focus of the HIV/AIDS money. I think in most cases, what we see is that because of the limited definition in terms of the HIV and its indicators, at community level, the community-based organizations are now being innovative enough and have started developing programs that are, for example, empowering women, that are promoting access to education, promoting food security, promoting income security, because these are some of the areas or underlying causes that even at community level, they are beginning to understand the link between those areas and HIV/AIDS. And yet, we find that for some of the mechanisms, because we are so focused in terms of HIV and AIDS indicators, they do not allow for that community innovation to address the most underlying factors in terms of vulnerability to HIV and AIDS. And we also find that to be a problem. Now, working at the grassroots level as a civil society organization, we do have some recommendations, I think, and also some examples in terms of what we would want to see happen in order to improve or to facilitate equitable and also efficient flow of resources from the national level to the grassroots level where the community-based organizations operate. And one, what we'd like to see is a more stronger relationship between the government and civil society. There are resources that are flowing, for example, from various donors to civil society. There are resources that are also flowing from government, from donors to government. And these resources need to be coordinated. One area that we see is that without proper coordination at country level, it is usually resulting in a waste of resources. And a very good example is where you have two civil society organizations working in the same district, working with the same community-based organizations, and each providing resources, and that is not coordinated. And we find that to be a problem because we are wasting a lot of resources without coordinating them between government. It's not only that the resources flowing through government that should be coordinated, but also the resources that are flowing separately through civil society. We need to find a better mechanism to coordinate all those resources so that we don't waste the resources. And I'd like to give a very good example in terms of what's happening in my country, Malawi, as regards something that we are trying to do at country level to facilitate that flow of resources from national level to the grassroots organizations. And in Malawi, through the support of the Global Fund, we have the government of Malawi, together with civil society partners, have actually established what is called the Umbrella Mechanism, where civil society organizations are accessing the money from the National AIDS Commission, and the civil society organizations are then channeling the money to the community-based organizations. And that process has a number of advantages. One, because through our experience and comparative advantage as civil society organizations, we can easily reach the area in the various areas in terms of geographical coverage for the grants facility. And two, based on our experience in terms of capacity building, it's easy for us to support the community-based organizations after they've accessed the funding to also build their technical capacity as well as institutional capacity to really improve the quality of their programming. And I think I would also like to highlight another area that is essential in terms of making sure that resources are flowing to the communities, and that is that the procedures for funding should be simplified at country level. And this is an area that civil society and government should work together to make sure that both literate communities but also non-literate communities who are able to put together a very good concept can be supported regardless of their status in terms of education and ability to write a very good proposal with an M&D plan within their proposal. And also there's a role that civil society can play. And this role is something that has emerged, I think, in the last sitting of parliament in my country, where we saw a lot of debate happening in parliament as regards the health budget in terms of allocation. And this is an area that in Malawi right now, the civil society, we see it as an opportunity in terms of engaging, for example, with government institutions, particularly the parliament through the Parliamentary Committee for Health, to advocate and really support efforts to make sure that when the budgets are being discussed, the in-country allocations to support HIV and AIDS work, particularly at community level, is also being supported within the countries, other than just looking up to the outside donors to support the work within the countries. And lastly, I would like to really stress here that based on our experience as civil society, it is very important that governments and civil society really coordinate the way that we disperse the resources to the communities in order to avoid wasting the resources, which would in turn cause problems because other communities would not be able to access the such kind of funds, which we know that as of now we do not have adequate resources. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia, for your presentation. Now, as you know, the format of this session is we have asked the panelists to give their presentations, and now I would like to invite comments and the questions from the floor. As I see, there are two microphones there, one number one there, number two there. For those who have any questions and comments, please line up on the order of the speech. So that, if I could please ask you to limit it to one question or one comment per person. And when you raise in the question, please indicate to whom, which one is the panelist that you're addressing this question. So let's start with the one, the gentleman, please. I'm sorry, I couldn't see you very well.
Lady. Yeah. My name is Kathleen Oakes. I'm from New York. Nurses earn a steady income, although too low, but hopefully more than $1 a day. They're supposedly rare, or maybe they're just invisible. But in some countries, like Nigeria, 35,000 nurses are unemployed. I have been told this is due to the debt relief. I'm not clear why it's due to debt relief, but I need some explanation from anyone on the panel why rare, needed healthcare providers are unemployed in a country like Nigeria, 35,000. Also, a public health model talks about triage. Why are nurses not given access to ARVs so they could go back to work? Why are they forced to wait in line like everyone else? If public health, the flu vaccine says you give the healthcare providers so that they can go back to work. So anyone who can answer those two questions, why are nurses unemployed to relieve debt relief, and why aren't healthcare providers given priority to the ARV treatment when they need it, their T cells are below 200, so that they can go back to work?
Thank you. I take it as one combined question rather than two. Thank you. Please, on the left side. Please.
Yes. My question goes in line with the topic of the afternoon, which is HIV and poverty. So we all know, it's well documented, that health and development is established association. And we know also the staggering effects of HIV in health. Now, we've talked about human resources as one of the main constraints into delivering treatment services today in many countries. However, if we revise in depth the literature, we find that the work, infrastructure, and environment, and logistics is one of the main determinants for people to choose to go work elsewhere. Now, in terms of delivering tangible solutions, shouldn't we have, and this question goes to anyone in the panel can answer, shouldn't we have more direct foreign investment in countries that cannot invest enough in basic primary healthcare systems in which HIV services can be integrated into, so we can do large-scale treatment in those countries? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's take another one, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Jacinta Sweeney. I'm from the Africa Campaign for Disability and HIV, and my question is to the Parliamentary Secretary for Zambia. I enjoyed listening to how you were explaining the delivery of your National HIV and AIDS Strategic Plan, and I noticed that when you referred to marginalized groups, people with disabilities wasn't one of them. Also, when you listed the challenges in delivering the strategic plan, appropriate delivery of HIV and AIDS information to people of various disabilities was not one of these challenges. So are we to assume that people with disabilities and their access to HIV and AIDS education is not a priority for your country? If I'm wrong and it is a priority, could you explain what you're actually doing to deliver appropriate education? Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take one more. Yes.
My name is Isaac Silverman. I'm from timetodeliver.org. This is actually from Ms. Gupta. I was wondering how receptive women have been to the programs that have been set out for them, especially ones in the communities which have been the most marginalized, and what social and economic sphere most of the women who are taking advantage of the programs have been from.
Thank you. If I may just stop there, and then the first question on the nurse. Ambassador, would you like to take it on?
Yeah, I'm sure that my colleague from Zambia also might want to comment very briefly on that. But the health personnel issue has been an issue that has called for a lot of attention the last year. And there are both these structural issues within countries, and of course there are these migration issues and dealing with the flow of nurses as a scarce resource from, for instance, Africa to countries in the north. The reason why a country cannot employ all the trained nurses if they're lucky to have them is, of course, the size of the public budget. And if there is a debate with external partners, including the financing institutions, and if there is an effort to get the economy going, then there are some clues as to how much of your money you actually can invest in personnel. And as you know, personnel is one of those expenditures that one watch very thoroughly. Now, this is the reason why some of the voices in the networks around the personnel crisis have been talking about sort of making exceptional clauses, because this is definitely vicious circles. If you don't invest, you're getting worse. If you invest, you may get in trouble with inflation or whatever. And this is a situation where, for instance, Zambia were really struggling really hard. But the treatment for nurses that was part of the question, and I take the I'm also moving a bit into the next question because of the work environment. There is an initiative just launched by WHO up today in this conference being launched that's called Treat, Train and Retain. And that concept is trying to bring together everything we know about work environment, about, you know, what motivates people to stay, the fact that we do need to pay health workers. We can't just think that they can keep on with the heavy load without pay, and looking at work environment, motivational factors, ways to keep them is one of the major areas where I think we'll see quite a bit of investment, external foreign investment, provided that this is a national priority. And I'm back to that. We can't fix this from outside. There's got to be people like Simon and others that say, now we are ready for that investment. And there need to be civil society, movements, activists, whatever, that say, we're ready for getting that priority onto our domestic spending, and that's how we will argue with the IMF.
Thank you, Madam Ambassador. Dr. Miti, would you like to respond to this Zambia's priority?
Yes, thank you. Not in order of the questions that were asked, but I'll try and attempt to answer or to respond, give remarks to one or two queries. Firstly, the issue of the Nigerian nurses. I think this is true because even Zambia has been trying to have some negotiations with the Nigerian government. But the difficulties that we've had is basically that the kind of conditions of service that are currently obtaining in Zambia are generally too low. Just for your information, a nurse in Zambia gets about $300 per month. And it would appear the Nigerian nurses are not willing to come and get this kind of money. They would rather probably do something else than come to Zambia, but we're still negotiating. On the issue of the nurses, in Zambia, the nurses are free to access ARVs. However, one of the major challenges that we've faced is the issue of stigma. So they tend to be on self-medication, and when it's too late, then, you know, they are not monitoring themselves properly, and therefore we have deaths. In terms of the human resources issues, in Zambia we have a plan, we have a costed plan, and for 1 year, the plan is about $2 million US dollars, just for 2006, and these resources have not been mobilized. But what has happened is on a pilot scheme, we have a rural retention scheme by the Dutch government where the doctors are now willing to go to the rural areas. In 2002, we only had about six saving rural areas. But when this rural retention scheme was developed, we now have about 80 doctors who have actually gone to the rural areas. And I think this has really helped in scaling up the HIV/AIDS interventions. Other than that, we've got PEPFAR through USAID in the bilaterals and some multilaterals. On the issue of the exemption mechanism, which I referred to, yes, the disabled people are part of that group. That's why I said ETC, and you know, although ETC maybe is not very good, it looks like they could be under that arrangement, but certainly the disabled are also exempted from paying any medical user fees, and the extension of the ARVs policy, free ARVs, has also been extended to them. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Gupta, you have...
Yeah, the simple answer to the question is they are very receptive, but obviously to programs that are well-designed, that provide them the social support, because in giving women property and inheritance rights, you are sometimes changing the status quo, which can create reactions within the community. And some women themselves sometimes feel that that might be damaging and, you know, are sort of reticent to accept that change. So it takes some work. It takes some community mobilization and education. And there are different ways in which you can begin small and then do the bigger stuff later. But it has been done, and in those successful programs, women are happy to be able to get joint tenure to land, to be able to get the help in writing wills, so then when their husbands die, they have some legal right to get the paralegal services to help them access the legal system and know how to do that. Those are initiatives that have worked in several places.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia. Any comments on this side, response?
I think on the two questions, looking at the, maybe I can just comment on the situation of the nurses in Malawi, that this is a big problem. Maybe Malawi government should talk to Nigeria, although I know they can't come because I'm looking at $300 from Zambia and I'm saying, wow, that's almost twice what a nurse is paid in Malawi. So I think really this is an area that we really need to look into in terms of the health infrastructure, and I think we cannot ignore the role of the human resource. In Malawi, through the support of the Department for International Development in UK, in the United Kingdom, we've started something where we're working with the UK government to top up the salaries for the health workers so that, you know, they can stay in Malawi. But even the top up, it's not a large amount of money, but at least it's something better. But also, I think when we talk about problems in terms of nurses leaving, there's another trend that we see in our country, and this is a trend where we find a lot of nurses working in NGOs and in programs that are not even, you know, requiring their services and nurses. And I think this is an area that we also need to look into at country level, because if they were working in professions that were at least in line with, so that they could provide some of the services they could, that could have been an opportunity. But what we see is that that is a loss, and it's not actually going out of the country. This is something that's happening within the country, and it's something that we really need to look into. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's take more questions, please.
Chris Desmond from South Africa. As we know, I mean, being poor in and of itself does not give you HIV. It's the context in which that poverty occurs and the behaviors which result. I mean, we're looking at the roles played by inequalities associated with poverty, and also in the African context, the huge scale of labor migration that results in order for people to survive in such situations of poverty. But these are fundamental social problems. So I'm asking, in this context, when we're seeing an epidemic driven by fundamental social problems, that we're still talking about small-scale interventions. important interventions were mentioned in the presentations, but we're still talking about at a very small level. And what we need to be asking for, and conferences like this need to be asking for, is fundamental social change to address the imbalances which have led to the problems which we're dealing with. If we want to break the cycle between HIV and poverty, we need to break poverty. And if we want to break poverty, we need that fundamental change. And that's not just fundamental change domestically. If we want interventions that will start to have an immediate impact on those at risk in Africa from HIV, we need to talk to the West about how keeping their farmers happy is killing African women, how subsidies and trade restrictions in the West continue to kill us. And once we can see that, then we can stop as Africa going around the world with a begging bowl asking for help when we're left in such a predicament.
Thank you. Your comments, please.
Joanne Omang, I'm with Ms. Magazine and Planet Wire. I know that you are aware of many donors' concerns that corruption is a problem in many poor countries, and they hesitate to throw good money after bad. Some countries, notably the United States, have adopted what they call a policy demanding good governance as a condition of supplying aid. I'd like to ask the panelists, first, to discuss the question of corruption, and secondly, the impact of these good governance approaches to aid on the poor people at both the government and the community level.
Thank you. Let's take another one.
Yeah, my name is Hans Bilimoria. I run a HIV/AIDS intervention program, community-based, in the city of Pune in India. And my question is actually very, very linked to the other question. My brother from Malawi was talking about accessing funds at country level, international level. And the problem that we face is corruption. It's not a problem of capacity. We have a great volunteer base, and we can write the proposals. We write it to the national government. We write it to the local government. But the money does not come. Or it comes with a caveat. You give us a 20% kickback, we will send in our accountants to cook your books. This is serious. So again, where corruption, it's a dirty word. I was expecting corruption to be addressed by the panel, and I'm glad my friend brought it up. But it is a problem, and what does the panel have to comment on this? Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take another one.
Melissa Roach, University of North Carolina, and I have a question for Dr. Miti. There's evidence emerging that one of the primary barriers for starting ARVs and also adhering to ARVs is food security, both in terms of having adequate access to food and proper nutrition. And I was wondering if you could speak about how food security and nutritional provision is part of Zambia's interventions.
Thank you. Let's take another one.
Yes, my name is Chebet Maikut from Uganda. I'm from the farming sector background, but heavily involved in campaign against HIV/AIDS activities. Now, first of all, I'm happy that a sister who has just spoken there has addressed one concern of food security. So most important, I would like to touch on two issues. One is the question of discrimination and racism in terms of institutions and structures that are providing a big impediment in terms of the overall program of HIV/AIDS and poverty. And I would like to cite specific example. Last year we had an experience where somebody who was going to pursue postgraduate studies on AIDS, on health, so to say, public health, was found to be HIV positive. And therefore, the recipient country where that person was going to pursue her studies was denied access. But I won't go far, but I can maybe mention here, for example, two countries with respect to Uganda, Egypt and, for example, Australia. I think are stringent in terms of the serious status of a student or somebody going to pursue studies in their countries, and they are denied that opportunity to further their education because of their serious status. So I'd like perhaps to comment, because that has a great bearing in terms of the human resource and also, secondly, the poverty question. Secondly...
Yeah, please, limit it to one, please. I think we have to give the chance to other speakers who are behind you. Thank you. Okay, let's go to the left side.
Hi, this is for... I'm Karen Baird from Purchase College, State University of New York, and this is for Dr. Gupta. Thank you for highlighting the issues of gender and poverty, development, HIV, and AIDS. And you focused on the need for property rights and inheritance rights for women. And it seems to implement this change as well as many other needed reforms, we need quite often some basic cultural change around gender norms. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for enacting some of those basic cultural norms to enact changes that just basically would value women and respect women and their rights in certain contexts.
Thank you. I want to honor everyone, so if you can just quickly raise your comment or question, please. I mean, all of you, please.
Certainly. Carol Dover with Voluntary Service Overseas, VSO Talk at AIDS in Papua New Guinea. On a similar line, I wanted to thank Dr. Gita for acknowledging the link between land tenure and the marginalization of women. In Papua New Guinea, we have only one female member of parliament who I believe is attending this conference, and women suffer from very low social status in Papua New Guinea. Our government is pushing towards land registration of traditionally owned lands, which is 85% of the land. And surely this will further marginalize women and youth. So I wanted to ask you, would you advise that we target our advocacy at the top, at the government level, or that we continue to strengthen grassroots organizations and hope that we make sufficient gains before the land registration is fully mobilized?
Thank you.
Let's go for next. Yes, I'm Lul from Southern Sudan. My concern is it's very serious. I was expecting one of you should highlight it. But the concern is this. They say for every one American dollar or Western dollar checking to Africa for all the projects, 67% of that dollar come right back to where it came from, either in terms of the salaries or in terms of the operation fees or in terms of the meetings or transportations and others. And I think that's very, very serious. If we're talking about the people are not getting ARBs, and now all those money that was raised, they end up in wrong place instead of ending up in programs that's supposed to help those people. I think that's the things that need to be addressed at the high level. Thank you.
I guess the queue is getting longer. I thought it was maybe I may have to limit to one there and one there. Yes.
My name is Wilson Zulu from the Network of Zambian People Living with HIV and AIDS. And I had an observation on the presentation from my colleague from Malawi. I wanted to put it to your attention that despite the fact that in Africa, we tend to be poor, and of course, African countries are poor. Don't you think that the conditions that are attached to the grants or on accessing the funds are the ones which makes it very difficult for the implementation of HIV programs and interventions by service organizations and community-based organizations to do successful implementation of whatever programs, because they might come up with a viable project which is addressing a certain a particular issue which needs to be paid attention to at that particular moment. But because of the conditions that are attached to the donor funding, they will tell you to say, you have to use this money on such a thing when you are supposed to address something. Don't you think that hampers the progress and the way we are supposed to achieve and implement these programs successfully?
Thank you. Last one, please.
Thuong Nguyen from Vietnam. I'd like to see how Dr. Miti, do you or would you have the plan that you would not depend on funding from BEPFA, who set so many conditions against sex work, where the country where I'm from, like many women use sex work as a means for their living. I can tell you countless number of women, and they love to enjoy doing sex work as a means for living. Would you have a plan not to depend on dole funding so you can respect sex worker doing sex work, but like also like access to HIV prevention? I dream the day that my country would not depend on that. Vietnam is the only Asian country who have BEPFA program.
Thank you very much. Well, I'd like to just thank you for everyone for contributing, but I am afraid due to the time limitation, I have to close the comments and the intervention from the floor. Now, I'd like to invite the panelists to pick up any of the comments now, because we have about 10 points made. So let's start from the far end. Mr. Castillo, would you like to start? Any points you'd like to take?
Yes, I think I'd like to take the question in terms of the corruption and the good governance. I thought that was a very good area. And I think on our side as civil society, it's an area that we should continue to advocate and engage government in terms of ensuring that resources are being used for their intended purpose. In Malawi, for example, we have two organizations. We have what we call a user group for the sector-wide approach, and we also have the Malawi Health Equity Network. And these organizations are really looking at how are resources being used, HIV as resources, but also health resources at the country level, and making sure that these resources have to be used for the intended purpose. And if they are not used for the intended purpose, engaging with other government structures, like even the Parliamentary Committee for Health, and ensuring that that is brought to the attention of appropriate institutions at country level, so that that raises the profile of those issues, and then that generates some action to it. If I can give you a very good example, our Parliament debated on the health budget, and they were issues that they started seeking clarification because civil society had done a lot of advocacy, had done a lot of, raising those issues, and the parliamentarians were able to understand those issues and, take them seriously. And the other issue is that when we demand accountability and good governance, it's not just at the government level, but also as civil society and community-based organizations that are accessing funding have to be accountable and have to show good governance in terms of how they are using those funds. And the mechanism that we are using in Malawi, when we fund a community-based organization, we want the community to, the CBO to be accountable to the community, to be accountable to the community leaders, so that there's also that accountability, even in terms of the civil society that are accessing funds. The other area I think that I'd like to touch on is the area that my colleague John from Zambia has raised in terms of the conditionalities that are attached to some of the grants. And I think this is really an area that we need to also focus our energies on in terms of advocating, not just at country level, but at international level. I mean, I'll give an example that you support an organization, a community-based organization that is doing home-based care, and the funds that they have accessed cannot even be used to buy home-based care kits. And so you wonder that if the money is only going to be used for training and they can't even buy home-based care kits, what are they going to do in terms of home-based care? So indeed, I think we really need to advocate as civil society. I think that's our comparative advantage in terms of making sure that we are linking with others with similar concerns at national level and international level so that some of these conditionalities can be removed. I already talked about, I think, the definition of HIV and its indicators in terms of sometimes how narrow that can be for other people, and that also can limit the scope of the HIV/AIDS work that we can do, for example, in terms of supporting work to promote income, economic empowerment at community level, promoting access to education. And I think this is something that we need to engage with our National AIDS Council at country level. But also this is something that needs to be explored with the National AIDS, the UN AIDS, in terms of how do we broaden this understanding in terms of the response to HIV so that the funding mechanisms can allow for that innovation in terms of addressing the different parts of the same problem. I think I'd like to stop there.
Thank
for
you.
Now.
Thank you, Mr. Cassie. Dr. Gupta, please.
Okay, I'm going to answer a few of these that were raised. First, to the South African gentleman who talked about big scale fundamental changes rather than small scale efforts. I just want to point out that we need both. We need interventions at all levels simultaneously, as many as we can get going, in order to create a momentum for change. There is no doubt that trade policies and agriculture subsidies are incredibly important, just as many of the economic policies that were raised earlier and the health systems issues that we've been discussing are very important macro context issues that we must pay attention to. By virtue of the nature of these panels, each of us picks one issue, and I picked the one I did, but I just want to emphasize I couldn't agree with you more. But they're all important. All of that has to happen simultaneously, unfortunately. The second, to the gentleman from Pune in India, about corruption in trying to get money from the government that was intended for community-based organizations. I want to tell you that in the early 90s, I think it was 1994 actually, there was an effort by donor agencies, bilateral agencies in Europe and the US, they recognized that community-based organizations were the ones that were producing successes in responding to the HIV/AIDS epidemic, much more than governments were. And they didn't have a mechanism whereby they could give the money directly to community-based organizations in developing countries. They had to go through governments. And so there were a lot of these meetings that were held that I actually participated in, where we were one of the organizations asked to do some of the case studies to find out that if what would be the mechanisms that would work to fund community organizations directly. That is what created the International HIV/AIDS Alliance, which was thought to be the mechanism through which linking organizations could be created in different countries, money could be dispersed faster to community-based organizations without too much being skimmed from the top, without having to go through the government. It's one effort that was made, and I just want us to raise this issue repeatedly, because I think in this epidemic, to try and get money directly to community-based organizations is critical, to try and figure out how to do that. We have done that in the past. In the women's movement, we did it very successfully around Cairo and Beijing. What were the mechanisms we used then? And why can we not sustain those mechanisms? Why is it that those same organizations that made those big policy changes happen are now struggling to survive? The ones that we used to create those big policy changes. And they can now be our implementers if we do it right in the ways that were discussed by the other panelists. So I think that this is a big challenge to us, and that's why I raised it. It is also the answer to the social and cultural change that must occur in order for the property rights and other gender inequalities to be rectified. Those will happen from within. You cannot from the outside go in and bring about social and cultural change. They happen because civil society and those organizations demand those changes. But for that to happen, they have to have the capacity, the technical resources, the money. Money is incredibly important. They don't need only seed grants. They need the money it takes. Yes, they may not be able to immediately absorb it, but they can be. The capacity for them to be able to manage it and absorb it and use it can be built. And it's just we haven't done enough in that regard. And finally, in terms of the Papua New Guinea question, in terms of advocacy from the top or from the bottom, again, both. Both. The most effective programs have occurred when policymakers have been reached at the top to create the legal frameworks and legal contexts and legislative sort of frameworks for change from the bottom to occur, while the folks from the bottom are pushing for them to then make that happen. So I would say you really do need both. And that's where the few successes that exist in the women and development movement, that's what succeeded for us.
Thank you, Dr. Thank you, Dr. Midi.
Thank you very much. I will also touch on one or two areas that were mentioned, and I'll probably start with the issue of corruption. Certainly, corruption makes business very, very expensive. In Zambia, you may wish to note that the political commitment and leadership at that level, where the president himself has said he will not tolerate corruption, zero tolerance to corruption. This has ensured that the structures, the law enforcement structures of the Anti-Corruption Commission, the Drug Enforcement Commission, and he had to also establish a specific task force on corruption. And for those of you who may be reading international papers from Zambia, one of the clear demonstrations by the current president is where the former president and the leaders are actually facing corruption charges in courts. And I think that is a clear demonstration of what is happening in Zambia. In as far as the other structures are concerned, when you talk about the basket issues in Zambia, for resources to be disbursed, it is performance-based. So you must be able to demonstrate that the indicators and the monies that were sent to the ministry have actually reached the hospitals, have reached the districts, and so on. And you have to agree on the performance-based indicators to ensure that, you know, those things are done. On the issue of food security as it relates to HIV and AIDS, yes, this is a very, very challenging area because persons on the ARVs who probably have HIV and AIDS invariably have also TB and other opportunistic infections. And they tend to want more nutrition, particularly at that stage. However, in the sub-Saharan Africa, in Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Zambia included, sometimes we've faced a challenge of drought. And I think this has really caused major problems. And then there's also been some difficulties with the GMO foods and so on. And I think that, again, has caused difficulties. However, it is also important to recognize that the poor conditions of service has made most of the breadwinners not able to afford, you know, 3 meals per day or 2 meals per day. I mentioned that $1 per day is rather very difficult, even for a nurse who is only getting $300 per month. I think that is a major challenge. And the vicious cycle of poverty, HIV and AIDS, as well as the unemployment or employment but poor conditions of service tends to exacerbate that. The other issue is just on the salaries. We've had difficulties in Zambia to increase the salaries because there are some benchmarks that you have to follow. The IMF World Bank benchmarks of personnel emolument GDP ratio, that the ratio must be maintained up to a certain level, and therefore you are not supposed to increase any resources towards the personnel emoluments, and therefore the conditions of service tend to be stagnant for quite some time. Otherwise, if you increase them, then the debt relief will then be a problem. And so you have to balance as to what you really want. And I think that is a major problem. I would also want to add something on the civil society. I don't know whether if I heard you know, right, that some of the civil society organizations will have to get resources, but not to be accountable. I think that is quite a difficult issue. In Zambia, for instance, we have the Zambia National AIDS Network, and the first thing it did for it to establish itself is to ensure that it had systems of accounting, auditing, and so on. And I think in Zambia, it's working very well, because at the end of the day, they're able to provide some accounts of some sort. Otherwise, we've sometimes seen a situation where the husband in one community becomes the, you know, the NGO, and the wife as the accountant, you know, and resources are provided, and then they may not go to the intended purposes. So one has to be extremely careful to ensure that the resources are actually going to the intended purpose. Finally, is on the issue of the donor resources. In Zambia, as I mentioned, we have a basket. And what happens is we follow the three ones. So whether it's PEPFAR, whether it's DFID or any other donor, they actually buy into the National Health Strategic Plan. And at the end of the day, we're able to determine exactly where they are filling the gap, other than them coming up with vertical programs, which invariably causes major difficulties. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Miti. Ambassador.
Let me first say that I'm very encouraged that AIDS activism now take on the challenge of fundamental social change. And I think this is a breakthrough. This is happening around this year. At least we haven't heard it that clear, and it can overcome the gap between that I talked about in the beginning, between sort of the development community, even the development NGOs and the AIDS. I believe that linking the struggle now is about the most important things we can do to see how these things relate together. it is important to use the momentum of AIDS to watch and challenge and understand how these structures have a bearing on it. And I just want to say that this should happen both at the international level and the national level. And for social change to come about, as we just heard, it has to come from within. But in terms of human personnel, for instance, there is quite a bit of effort now to see how one can deal with some of the brain drain issue by making it transparent, by trying to negotiate deals between the countries that grab resources and those that let them go, as it were, to look at to what extent are countries willing to make deals that one can follow and watch, because this is also an area of transparency and mutual accountability. Then the other subject I wanted to comment, of course, is the issue of governance and effective use of money. There again, quite a few countries do not have an overview of the resources coming into the country. Basic to any control of corruption is transparency in resource flows. We heard from one country that you had a parliamentary committee like Malawi that would question. A lot of parliaments do not know the kind of money that comes in, whether it is to an NGO or whether it is to a government program. So having the overview, having the mechanisms of accountability there is essential. Let us remind each other that also NGOs can be tempted for corruption. This is basic human sin, I think. I think that watch mechanisms, keeping on, having information that you can check is important for all of us. And that should be something that we ask for to protect ourselves too. Donors can do quite a bit. Yes, we can demand, but a demand for zero corruption is most effective when it comes from media, civil society, parliaments inside, external. Of course, it has to be domestic spending as well as external spending. And again, it's sort of the overall use of that money at all levels that counts. Money coming back to the north. I think it is very important to be aware that these are different policies in different countries. One could have, a transparent mechanism that would watch that. Certainly donors have done quite a bit to work on effective spending, both in terms of what is spent in countries and what is spent overall. Multilateral agencies are in the same category that need to be working on this. The overheads, the actual transaction cost in development is very, very high. Now, how we can reduce that in ways that we make even more effective use of money, I think we all have to look at in those situations we are. But it's probably smarter to start closer to ourselves, our country, our organizations, rather than start at the big global thing where we cannot unpack those issues and thereby make them issues that we can watch. And I just want to have a final word on gender, because I really agree with everything being said on that. But I have a worry. I have met quite a few HIV-positive women that feel that the discrimination of them by women's organizations is actually even more heavy than they have in the society at large. Again, we need to look into ourselves and see how do we watch, what hinders the response, and how can we empower each other to act together, because we need each other if we should overcome and provide universal access. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Singham. I have now an impossible job to summarize what we discussed, so I won't do it. But all I can say is just repeat what the Ambassador said earlier. It's not that we have never made any progress or we still don't know a lot of things. I think we, within this room, today you must have realized there's a whole lot of knowledge and understanding on the challenges we face. It is a matter of really delivering, doing it. And I think the theme of this conference precisely captures that spirit. Let's do it. I'm not speaking on behalf of a particular maker of a sporting goods that let's do it, but let's do it. But I think that doing it, I think the challenge is really, again, the two-pronged challenges, the macro level and the global level at the community level. And I think sitting in New York at the policy level, I am painfully realizing every day that why we are going on the global and the macro issues, which are quite important, I think we cannot push this agenda any farther without having you, the community level organizations and the advocates and practitioners, tackling the issues, more sensitive and domestic issues seriously. The message I heard from the panelists today is let's get serious. Let's demystify all those words and jargons, empowering or respect or stigma and discrimination. Let's put it in a very concrete terms so that we can really tackle it and address it within a short period of time. Otherwise, we'll be talking forever and then, you know, go home happy because we realize the issues are there, but there's no comfort of just talking about it. So, thank you very much for the panelists for sharing your knowledge and expertise. Thank you very much for that. And I must thank you, all the audience. You stayed with us until the last minute, and thank you for your contribution. Thank you.